You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to Intercepted. I'm Justice Mosqueda here for Acme Packing Company, and I'm joined by Mark Bullock. Say what's up to people, Mark.
Hey, how's it going?
So on the front end, I want to plug your Substack. Can you talk about the work that you're doing there?
Yeah, so I break down the Washington football team on my Substack. It's markbullock.substack.com. I just break down basically all of the terrible things that they do every week currently and try to filter through what exactly they're doing wrong and see if I can give some kind of analysis on possibly how they fix things or generally just kind of cry about how bad they are.
So you're one of the most knowledgeable fans of the sport, I think, who is overseas. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how you got into the game? Because I really have very little perspective of like how non-Americans get into it. Like, I know Mexico, like how Mexico operates kind of, and it's like big teams, right? So it's like you got like a lot of people think like Cowboys and Raiders fans and stuff like that, but you'd be like surprised how many like Packers and like Cowboys or Steelers fans and stuff, you know, are in Mexico. Patriots fans even too. But outside of like you know, this half of the world, I guess, like how do you get into football? How do you kind of follow the game? How do you get into it? Like where is your knowledge base start from and build through? Like, I don't understand that, because me personally, like, I play the game, I coach the game, and that's kind of how I know it. But I understand like these structures aren't built everywhere.
No. I kind of had a connection to, I lived in the States when I was younger for 5 years. My dad's job took us out there. And so just before I turned 5, we moved out there, and just before I turned 10, we moved back. So I kind of grew up with a bit of American culture instilled in me. And I was kind of a little bit young to get into football at that point. I was more into basketball and a little bit baseball, a little bit hockey. And when I came back to England, I kind of naturally fell into the English sports. But I've always been kind of breaking down why things happen in sports. That's always interested me. Like, my dad was always kind of a shout at, "Oh, referee, what are you doing?" Or, "What is this player doing?" And that kind of thing. And that kind of irked me. And I was like, well, maybe there's a reason they're doing that. And so I kind of tried to take a little bit more of an analytical approach of, well, why does that player do this thing? And maybe that wasn't his fault that you're shouting at him incorrectly. So soccer, our football over here, it's kind of a fast flowing open game. So it's not as easy to kind of break that down, that kind of thing. Whereas American football, your football is, every single play is scripted. It's designed specifically for a reason, and each player has a specific assignment to do on each play and that kind of thing. So it lends itself to that kind of approach. And I think when I kind of got to sort of 18, 19, I kind of was drawn to that sport because of that approach. And so at that point, I kind of naturally followed kind of Washington, because that's roughly where I was, where I lived when I was out there. So I kind of fell into the Washington teams and kind of wishing my dad had lived somewhere else to follow a somewhat better team. But, you know, that is what it is. So, yeah, I've always kind of taken that approach to sports, and the NFL kind of lends itself to that. And I guess from terms of learning where my knowledge base comes from, it comes from following people like yourself and other good writers and coaches and reading as much as I can, watching as much as I can, and kind of just always asking, why is that player doing that thing? And within what structure is he trying to do that thing? And kind of going from there. And over time, I've been fortunate that there's been some pretty good coaches in Washington as well, guys like Kyle Shanahan and the Sean McVays and the Flores and all of that have been in Washington. So I've kind of grown up with that offense. That's kind of all I knew until the last few years. So I kind of didn't realize just how spoiled I was by learning those kind of offenses and that kind of concepts and how football works via that. So yeah, I think it's come from just years of being a kind of a sports nerd and wondering why and watching plays and spending far too much of my spare time trying to learn the game.
So out there, do you think that they will be able to support like an NFL franchise in like a traditional sense? Obviously right now, right? They can do the whole, the NFL's coming into town. Everyone packs the stadium. They cheer too loud for the field goals. And, and you know, you look at the crowd and it's just a cluster of jerseys. Just, yeah. It could be anyone, right? You could be like the Jets Falcons game. And there's people there with like Browns jerseys from like the 90s and stuff.
For sure.
And I know, like, you know, specifically kind of like how Europe looks at like soccer teams, right? Like they're very entrenched into the local areas in ways that like NFL franchises don't necessarily aren't, I guess I would say. Yeah. In that, like, there's pushback against like the Super League and stuff like that, right? So sure. If the NFL comes into town, it is kind of that Super League type of atmosphere to a certain extent, you know what I mean? It doesn't have that same type of, you know, the locals got together and they built this football club 100 years ago. Yeah. And now it's in the Premier League. That's not what's happening. It's they're being anointed. So would they be able to kind of support, you know, 8 home games for one single franchise? Do you think there's like a market for that right now?
I think it might be getting there. I don't know. The thing is, I think that there's kind of two generations of NFL fans, because the NFL first started becoming popular here in the kind of 90s. It first started getting shown on TV. And that's why there was a lot of Washington fans here initially, because it was early 90s. Washington won a few Super Bowls, or they won one at the start of the 90s, end of the 80s. And there's different fans from that era. And then there's fans from the newer era when they started bringing games to London. And as you say, like the London games, it's not a huge amount of Jags fans going to watch the Jags. It's just basically an event for NFL fans around the country to basically gather and meet other NFL fans and hang out and have a fun afternoon. And I mean, they sell out every single week. So I think they could certainly pack a stadium every week for 8 weeks. I don't think that's out of the question. I don't know how many people would change their allegiances, because as you say, kind of the culture here is once you're set on a team, that's your team. You're not changing teams. And I think that's kind of universal, right? Like you don't change teams unless there's some huge thing that causes you to, like they stop existing or they move town or whatever. So I don't know how many people would jump ship, but I think a lot of people would kind of take interest and be like, well, there's a team in London now, so that'll be my second team, and I'll watch them because they're here and I can actually go see them. But I'll still be a Washington fan or a Patriots fan or whatever, you know. I think there would be a market for it. I think they could sell it out. Whether they would have the kind of rabid fan base that you might get out there, I don't know. But you could argue that two teams in LA, they're not getting that kind of rabid fan base, but they're making enough money off of it to be all right. So yeah, I kind of think they probably could make enough money out of it to justify it, but I don't think they would get the huge rabid fan base that they might be hoping for.
Right. And, you know, talking about this team that you're covering right now, Washington, what I think they're a pretty good example of a team that realizes kind of how the league structure works in terms of collective bargaining, right? Where their attendance is super low, incredibly low right now. It's like 62% attendance, and that's including like the Sean Taylor day, which was also Patrick Mahomes is coming into town. Yeah. That's about like, I think that's 20% less attendance than any other team in the league right now. And it's like 30% less than like all but like three teams. And the other three teams are not very good at football right now. The big difference, right, is the NFL ownership has structured how the collective bargaining works. So like ticket sales can be collective bar, like it the revenue split, right, does go across the league to a certain extent. What doesn't go across the league is the boxes, the luxury boxes, which is why you're seeing every single NFL stadium now looks at AT&T, what they built, Jerry built in Dallas right now.
Sure.
Every team looks at that as like the blueprint where they're like, oh, this is how we keep money from Mike Brown of the Bengals. And this is how we keep money from Mark Davis of the Raiders. Like this is how we can keep our own money in our pocket locally. So I think that's kind of interesting. Speaking of this team, you said, you know, people don't change teams unless, you know, something massive happens. Washington seems like they're going through a little bit of that type of transition right now. So I'll give you my perspective on these emails first and foremost, and then I kind of want to get your thoughts. I thought it was very convenient at the front end that the stuff about the Morris Smith leaked out a day before they had the vote for the NFLPA. I thought that was very weird. I couldn't tell kind of where this stuff was leaking, because obviously there's only a handful of people who have these emails, right? The league must have had it because of the investigation. The Washington football team must have had it. And then obviously the original owners of those emails, right? I mean, Bruce Allen knows, you know, what he said, right? So there's only so many places that this can go from. At the front end, I thought this is probably coming from the league, right? Information doesn't come out by accident. Someone wants you to know it. On the front end, I thought, you know, this was maybe the league trying to get out of the Washington investigation by saying, we got someone, right? And then on the front end, the influencing a vote on who runs the union for the players, that would be a massive deal, right? Like that's a massive conflict of interest if you're able to do that in literally America's largest publication, which was the New York Times. It seems as this is unraveling, it is not coming from the league, because now the league's top lawyer is tied into this. And I don't understand why they would want to kind of shoot themselves in the foot in that way, right? So I really don't know where these emails are coming from. What's kind of your perspective on all of that? Because I'm trying to make sense of all this, and with what I have, and again, I'm looking at this from like, you know, 30,000 feet up type of view. It's not making sense to me.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to really put your finger on. There's some theory in Washington and around Washington people that the emails have come out as part of a thing between Bruce Allen and Dan Snyder. And Bruce Allen was obviously the team president in Washington for a decade, and he was kind of best buds with Dan Snyder, and he was his right-hand man, and then there was kind of a messy divorce at the end of it, and supposedly there's been legal battles between the two of them where Bruce Allen was trying to get the other part owners of the Washington football team to overthrow Snyder, or, you know, have stuff leaked about Snyder and get him forced out by the league. And so the whole thing with Snyder buying up the remaining ownership of the team and becoming the majority, well, the 100% owner a few months back kind of played into that. And then there's this legal battle going on between Snyder and Bruce Allen, where supposedly Snyder wanted some emails from Bruce Allen leaked or public. And I guess that these are part of that. And I guess it's to kind of show that, I don't know, maybe that Snyder's trying to pin the blame of stuff on Allen and the culture of stuff on Allen and anything that could get him legally in trouble on Bruce Allen rather than himself. And that's kind of the way those two have always operated in Washington, is they've tried to find the best guy they can to pin all of their troubles on and get that guy fired or, pushed out the door and pin the blame on them. And so it would not surprise me one bit to see those two dragging the NFL through a big legal battle between them and trying to pin the blame on each other. That would be, I guess, where all of this is kind of coming from, but I couldn't say for sure. That's definitely where it is.
Yeah, I read a theory a couple days ago that because there was a report from India that Dan Snyder is somehow linked to like Jeffrey Epstein and stuff like that. And that like, so Bruce Allen, you know, obviously from like the Adam Schefter stuff that came out, right? Like he is kind of a source, you know, a lot of times. And it seems like he's trying to link him to that and like trying to like distance himself from Jeffrey Epstein, which is probably a smart thing to do in 2021. Yeah. But yeah, just so many, just this story just keeps getting weirder for me. And it's just very odd. Talking about this football team specifically, you know, there were rumors this week that, you know, Washington was in part of a 3-team trade that would end up sending Deshaun Watson to Miami. And then they in return would end up getting Tua Tagovailoa. The team, someone from the team leaked to the media that that is not the case at all. So obviously that was just kind of like a rumor, but I think the truth that was told in that is that like Washington doesn't have their franchise quarterback right now. You know, Ryan Fitzpatrick was going to go into the year as a starter. He's on IR with that hip injury. I'm not necessarily sure when he's going to return from that, but then, you know, Taylor Heinicke is the starter right now for Washington. And we actually had him in the XFL. He was our backup actually in St. Louis when I was working for them in the league level personnel department. Heinicke was one of the best quarterbacks in the XFL. We just couldn't figure out a team that would take him and make him a starter. Because essentially the way that we had it structured was we gave every single XFL franchise a starting quarterback, and that guy basically got paid more than everyone else, right? Like those were individual contracts. And then we had the draft pool, which was everyone essentially gets paid the same. We had like escalator bonuses for wins, which is something different. For the XFL, basically, if you won a football game, you got paid twice as much. That's kind of how we incentivized winning with the XFL. I know they did it the first time around in like 2000 or whatever, completely different XFL organizations other than the top man. But it's a thought that, you know, Vince liked, so we kept it. Heinicke was a guy that we very much wanted to start. There were probably three starting quarterbacks going into the XFL season we knew Taylor was better than, but for whatever reason, those coaching staffs, they didn't want him, and they're running their own team, so we can only tell him so much, you know what I mean? But the fact that he stuck on with St. Louis, I thought was really good. Even when we looked at his practice reps, he was kind of like our get out of jail free card, where like if a quarterback would have gotten hurt, we would have been able to convince a team to trade him in some sort of way and get another starting caliber quarterback. So that a quarter of our games weren't unwatchable, right? That was kind of our plan with him. And then obviously Jordan Ta'amu did great with the St. Louis Battlehawks, and he ended up getting, I think he was on the Chiefs practice squad for a while. He should still be getting developmental reps somewhere. I really like what Jordan can bring to the table. But Taylor, I mean, has stepped up, has played not bad. I mean, he's not going to give you the explosives that, you know, you would think of like your traditional vet starting quarterback in the league, but he can kind of operate on time, right?
Yeah, he's been an interesting one because he's been a very much a roller coaster ride where he'll have some good games and some very bad games, and you never really know quite where you sit with him. And the comparison that people are making with him is Ryan Fitzpatrick, because he'll give guys an opportunity to go and make a play, and sometimes that will work and it'll pay off and it'll look good, and you'll have a 300-yard game with three touchdowns and no interceptions and being with a chance of winning it. And other weeks that will be 100 yards and four interceptions. And so that's kind of where we're at with him, where he's played a couple of tough teams, and I expect he'll be playing another a tough team this week, and we'll see how he manages going forward. But yeah, he's been up and down. I think he's actually not had too bad of a setup around him. The offensive line's been very good. The run game's been good when they've run the ball. At receiver, obviously, I think we're going to get on to a couple of the receivers, but Terry McLaurin's obviously a stud. and they've had some other guys step up around him. And so he's had some decent weapons and some opportunities. And when he has been kind of his natural self, he's made some good plays. He's used his mobility to kind of scramble around and extend plays and kind of make things off script. But there's been some opportunities, certainly last week that against the Chiefs that he missed. And there's a theory going around that they're coaching him to try to be a little bit more of a game manager than and take less risks. And that is resulting in him missing opportunities to throw the ball down the field. I'm not sure I 100% buy into that, but he certainly isn't just putting the ball out there the way he was earlier in the season.
So you already touched on Terry McLaurin. So McLaurin and Samuel were both did not practice yesterday. Recording this on a Thursday. Maybe they practice on this Thursday. We're doing this before noon Pacific time, so we don't have the injury reports yet. How big? I mean, it's obviously big, but do they have a chance to win the ball game if those guys can't play, or even if Terry misses the game? You know, do they have a chance? Is there enough explosive power offensively? Because, you know, Antonio Gibson, who's kind of like their explosive back too, if we're talking about, you know, a guy who can get 15 plus yard, you know, chunk plays and just move down the field, he's that guy, and he's on the injury report too. So it's like all the explosive guys are the guys that they might be missing this week.
Yeah, they went into the season kind of with a core of guys that you thought they have a decent set of weapons. They had Terry McLaurin is fantastic, and I think he'll establish himself as one of the best receivers in the league. Curtis Samuel is obviously a very dynamic threat. As you mentioned, Antonio Gibson is not in a too dissimilar role to Curtis Samuel, but he's a back rather than a receiver. And Logan Thomas emerged last year as a tight end. And three out of, well, as you say, all four of those guys are on the injury report right now. I'd be surprised if Terry McLaurin doesn't play. Curtis Samuel has kind of been, he's been battling an injury all offseason, and he didn't play for the most of the start of the season. And they kind of got him back for the last couple games, but he's been on a limited pitch count, and they've gone over that, and they've kind of felt like he's not necessarily fully himself yet. So I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't play. Gibson's been battling a shin injury, so I don't know whether he'll play or not. He's made it through the last few weeks after not practicing, but he was noticeably kind of limping at the end of last week, so I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to rest him. And Logan Thomas won't be back until next week because I think he went on IR. So Terry McLaurin, if he doesn't play, I don't see where the production comes from the passing game. They've had some guys step up. Ricky Seals-Jones as a tight end, he stepped up in place of Logan Thomas. They've got De'Ami Brown, the rookie from North Carolina, I think. He is a nice down the field threat, but he hasn't quite got on the same page as Heineke so far this year. I don't know whether he would be able to replace Terry McLaurin. It'd be a pretty tough job for him to do. And then they kind of got a bunch of guys like Adam Humphries and Dax Milne and that kind of thing that are decent players, but you're not going to get the explosive chunk plays out of them. So yeah, if Terry McLaurin isn't playing, then I have no hope for Washington. I don't think Washington will win anyway, but if Terry McLaurin's out, then yeah, they will, it'll be a long day for me.
All right, now that we've covered our bases, we're going to toss it to break, and then we'll get more in depth on kind of these matchups.
This episode is brought to you by Intuit, the technology platform that brings financial confidence with products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. You might have learned the recorder in school, but probably not how to navigate the financial world. Luckily, Intuit's on a mission to help with the free Intuit for Education program. It provides students with the lessons to learn essential skills, like how to build credit, file taxes, and budget. Check out their free resources at intuit.com/education.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, and we're back with Mark. Let's talk about when Washington has the football, first and foremost. So that offensive line, you said they've been doing good, but they're a little banged up right now. I know Cosme, Scherf, Leno, all three of them are on the injury report too. So not just talking about this passing game. Actually, let's start it with this. Adam Humphries. So you're going to remember Adam Humphries as the guy who got $40 million from the Tennessee Titans and then basically did nothing with it. I don't know if any player has ever gone from like, I'm a producer, I got paid, to just completely like falling out of like the thought of the general NFL base as much as him. How much is he doing for you guys right now? Because you talked about him before the break, you know.
Yeah,
he's a decent player, but he's not dynamic.
No, he's not dynamic. He's kind of their slot guy. And, you know, I think in an ideal world, they'd have Deami Brown playing the Z, Terry McLaurin playing the X, and Curtis Samuel would play in the slot instead. But because of Samuel's injury, Humphries has been playing the slot. And the idea was that Humphries has a connection with Ryan Fitzpatrick. They both had their best years together in Tampa Bay. So the thought was is that he'd be Ryan Fitzpatrick's go-to guy. But obviously Fitzpatrick went down in the first game and isn't due back until after the bye. So he definitely hasn't been on the same wavelength as he would be with Fitz as he has been with Heineke. So he's not a dynamic guy. He's kind of one of those little shifty slot receivers that can pick up 5 or 7 or 8 yards here or there, but you don't rely on him for chunk plays. To your comment of he's gone from the guy that got $40 million to doing nothing with it, I would say look at just about any Washington free agent for the past 20 years and you'd probably see a lot of guys in a similar situation. He's not a guy that moves the needle. Certainly he's a solid, productive football player, but he's nothing more than that.
So one benefit Washington is going to have going into this game is the fact that Green Bay's pass rushing unit is banged up. Obviously, they just signed Whitney Mercilus. He's at practice today. Who knows how much he's going to be able to get into the game? I mean, I don't think that it would be that hard to get a pass rusher, at least in situational reps, into the game off of a short week. You could look back at like Khalil Mack when he was traded from the Raiders. They got him quickly turned around against Green Bay, and he basically only played pressure packages, right? Because you have to learn the verbiage and the checks and all that stuff. Yeah. I think you can get Whitney Mercilus some reps in this upcoming game, but the fact that they have three guys on IR at outside linebacker, including Za'Darius Smith, that's a big deal in of itself. Preston Smith, back-to-back days, has not been practicing with an oblique injury. Really seems like he's probably not going to play. So you end up getting like two guys who pretty much don't bring anything off the bench. Garvin's done a little bit. Rashawn Gary, who's just a bull rusher, and then limited Whitney Mercilus snaps off of the bench, right? So that's kind of what these, you know, the football team is going to get. So if they're able to hold on to that ball a little bit, are they going to be able to get enough explosives? I guess a lot of that's dependent on the wide receivers being healthy, right?
Yeah, for sure. If Terry is in the game, then that's absolutely a winning matchup for them. I'm sure they'll try to dial up some stuff to Deami Brown as well, who was kind of a deep threat in college, and he has a little bit more to his game, but he's had a few struggles with drops, but they've been trying to hit some stuff to him down the field. They just haven't quite connected on that. So I would expect them to try to take some shots with those guys, especially with, as you say, the injuries with the pass rushers. And Washington's offensive line has been pretty good in both the run game and in pass protection. You mentioned they did have injuries to Cosme at right tackle and Brandon Scherff, but they've had Wes Schweitzer step in at right guard. He was the starter at left guard last year. And they had, I can't remember the backup tackle's name right now, but he started last year at left tackle and is now their backup swing tackle, so he's starting at right tackle now. And those guys stepped in last week against the Chiefs and held up admirably. So I don't think pass rush will be too much of an issue with them for them. Obviously, as you say, Packers are missing some guys, so I think that could be a chance for Heinicke to hold onto the ball and let those down the field shots develop. It's whether A, Terry McLaurin's fit and healthy, ready to go, and B, whether they can scheme some stuff up with De'Ami Brown and Terry together, which generally they're pretty good at. It's whether Heinicke can connect on it.
Just one note that I want to bring up. Jay Sternberger is a tight end for you guys now. You guys signed him to the 53.
Yes.
He is infamous in Green Bay for being the pick before Terry McLaurin. I want to put that on your radar. A lot of screenshots. Yeah, I know, because you're not like in the depths of Packers fandom brain. There's been the amount of times that draft class, the 2019 draft class, is like Wikipedia page with, mm-hmm. you know, him being just one slot ahead of Terry McLaurin. It's been screenshotted a million times and put on Twitter.
Sure.
I just want to put that on your radar. Last thing that I want to touch for kind of this matchup with, you know, Washington holding the ball, because, you know, I think we've talked about their offense enough. Darnell Savage returned to practice today. He had a concussion. He's their starting safety. He's very good in terms of like man coverage skills. Not necessarily him playing man, but like, you know, match coverage skills is the same
sure.
thing. His movement skills are great. He has ball skills, you know, even though what's his name? Chase got him on one against the Bengals. And then Kevin King is practicing for the second straight day after having a shoulder injury that's kind of kept him out the last 2 weeks. So hopefully they're getting a little bit more healthy on the back end. But the guy I wanted to talk about, Chase Roullier, the center. So he's going to need to come up big, because Kenny Clark is having a legitimate Pro Bowl type of season since week one. He kind of had a rough start week one, but then since then he's been doing good. Chase was a guy I always liked. So he was the center for Josh Allen at Wyoming. And if you watch that Wyoming offense, they kind of built their offense around Chase Roullier. Like, they would run behind him. They would do pin and pull stuff that no one else would do with their center because of how athletic he was. And it shows up on film sometimes. I know it's been a little bit up and down, but how has he been playing this season? And how do you think he's going to hold up against Kenny Clark?
Yeah, he's been doing really well this season. He's really stood out to me. He actually got a contract extension in the offseason to be their starting center. And actually last week against the Chiefs, I think he was mic'd up, or someone on the defensive line was mic'd up that was real near him. And just before every single snap, you could hear him making all the calls. And it was amazing for a nerd like myself hearing him making all the calls and identifying the mic, and like he was doing all of that. They didn't put that on Heinicke. That was all on Roullier. And so he certainly has a big role on that offensive line. And he was rewarded with his contract in the offseason, and he's been playing up to it this year. They've been doing a lot more sort of play action passes with a pulling guard, because they know Roullier can shift across and cut off a three technique trying to penetrate on with the pull. So they've been doing a lot of that as part of their play action game, and he's been holding up. They obviously trust him on screens, as you say, the pin pull kind of stuff in the run game. If Brandon Scherff is back healthy, which I'm not sure he will be, but I know he's been kind of working to the side at practice the last few days, so I guess there's a chance. When those two are together, they love those pin pull runs to the right with those two pulling out, and they do a phenomenal job doing that. So yeah, Chase Roullier has been playing very well. And the thing that has stood out to me more than anything else has been with Sam Cosmi being a rookie at right tackle, he struggled early. And what the offensive line's been trying to do is let Brandon Scherff slide across to him as often as possible. Obviously they'll chip every now and again and with a tight end or what have you, but they've been trying more often than not to have Scherff slide across. And that will often leave Roullier one-on-one with a nose tackle. And he's been picking that up very well. So overall, I think he's been doing a phenomenal job. How he'll do one-on-one with Kenny Clark, I don't know if he'll handle that necessarily one-on-one the whole game. And obviously, you wouldn't design that as the plan. And without Cosmi at right tackle to worry about, or perhaps without the pass rushers that you mentioned that are out missing on the edge, that they might not necessarily have to slide the guard out to help on the right tackle side. So they might be able to keep a little bit more solid interior and double up on Clark. I'd imagine that will probably be their focus with their pass protection plan this week.
Flipping to the other side of the ball, just want to talk about Green Bay a little bit on the front end. David Bakhtiari has returned to practice. He has 19 days to return to the team off of IR. I don't know if he's going to go this week. I would assume that he's probably not, just because the way that they've talked about him, they've basically said, we don't want to rush it, right? So whenever you hear the staff say, we don't want to rush it, I'm immediately going to think, all right, he's not going to play this week. So that's kind of this situation up front. Josh Myers is out at center. They had a backup come in, Lucas Patrick. He did actually a pretty good job. Everyone on that staff said that he graded up as their top offensive lineman in last week. So I don't think that's going to change by any means. Their weak point is kind of Royce Newman, who's been playing right guard for him. He did really well in the preseason, and he's had some struggles. Some of it has been like mental lapses and not being able to pass off stunts correctly. But Billy Turner at right tackle has kind of been just like the only vet on their line who has started every game. And Rodgers has applauded him and said, maybe he should be considered for Pro Bowl this year. I don't know if I would go that far, but he's been doing pretty solid. So up front, even though they've had a lot of kind of turnover, I mean, they at certain points they had Elgton Jenkins out, they had David Bakhtiari out, and now they have Josh Myers, their center, out. So that whole kind of left side of the line has been a little bit of a trouble. And then right guard, they've had some issues, but Billy Turner's kind of been that guy. Offensively, I think their biggest problem right now, MVS is out, so they don't have a speed guy downfield. That's another thing that should probably be noted. He hasn't returned to practice this week with that hamstring injury that he sustained against the Detroit Lions. Their biggest issue right now, they don't have tight ends that can play every down. And that's becoming increasingly important as they face good fronts. So like against Chicago went into a lot of bear stuff, which kind of takes out a lot of the zone game. If you're going to play bear, basically what it is you essentially have three defensive tackles up front, right? So when you have three defensive tackles up front, you can't run inside run. Okay, well, you want to run outside, right? Wrong. The way that they line up their outside backers is they widen them out. So you can't win one-on-one on those stretch blocks, especially if it's Robert Tonyan going against Robert Quinn or Khalil Mack. So now what do you do? Their answer was they ran a bunch of like power and counter, essentially, but they couldn't get into it with Tonyan. They couldn't, because Tonyan is getting his butt whipped in the run game. So you either have to concede and say, okay, Mercedes Lewis is out there, he's going to be able to get some of these blocks, but he can't block counter because you don't want him pulling and going across the formation. That's not what you want to do with him. You want him in a three-point stance, and you want him just teeing off against that defensive end. So they had to use DeGuara, actually. The guy everyone made fun of for being a fullback or whatever. They had to use him kind of as that move guy who would, pull across the formation on counter and stuff. Sure. But DeGuara has gotten his ass ripped by Aaron Rodgers for not knowing what to do in the passing game. So there's a lot of things going on in that tight end room. Another thing to note, 95% of the time, this is a real stat, 95% of the time that Robert Tonyan is lined up in the slot, it's a pass. And even filtered out of like empty stuff, because Green Bay is going into a lot more empty this year instead of like split back gun and all sorts of stuff like that, just because they're using the tight end to help kind of chip these edge rushers. When they had Josh Nyman, basically a practice squad player playing left tackle, they definitely needed a lot more help on the edges. When they're not in empty, so they're like typical one back gun stuff, like what you think of, like when you think of shotgun, it's still 92% of the time pass when Robert Tonyan's in the slot. Yes. And if I know that, Jack Del Rio should know that, and Ron Rivera should know that, right? So that's one of my biggest worries coming into the game, is just they're not really getting production out of the tight end position, and that's got to change at some point. And maybe that's their next, recruiting obstacle when a guy gets cut, you know, near the deadline and wants to chase a ring or something like that, and they add him for a vet minimum. Maybe the next position's tight end, but they're just not getting it done done at that position, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing for the Packers in that regard is that Washington has been horrible defensively. And even if you're telling that you're going to pass, there's one thing knowing that the pass is coming, and for Washington, it's a completely different thing trying to defend that pass, because their units have been so disjointed. The weird thing is that the last few weeks, you would think that defensive line matches up well and gives Washington's defense an advantage. And I mean, it did last week against the Chiefs. They had some injuries up front, and you have that defensive line with four first rounders, and you can chuck in Matt Ioannidis in there as well. And you think that should be enough to get pressure, and it did get some pressure, but it's such a disjointed unit. It's the defensive line. They've been doing a little bit better recently of running stunts and stuff, but for the most part, it's just been four guys go rush and they end up in the same lane, or they break contain, and quarterbacks are, especially guys like Rodgers, that can move around. We saw it with Josh Allen. We saw it with Mahomes last week. Like, Chase Young can be a little bit ill-disciplined still, and he'll get run off the edge and give that huge lane for the quarterback to scramble to the right. So that, I think, is still a big plus for the Packers, and trying to cover guys has just been a huge ordeal for Washington. They it seems like everyone's on different pages. Like, the secondary are all individually talented guys, but you have a guy like William Jackson, who's more of a press man corner. You have and opposite him, you have Kendall Fuller, who's more of a off guy, a zone guy, likes to play with vision on the quarterback, and they don't kind of mix together well. And you've kind of seen that throughout the whole season so far, is that it's kind of been a bunch of individuals occasionally making plays, but when it comes to a coverage unit, it's kind of all broken down and gone terribly wrong, and they've given up a lot of big plays and a lot of points.
Yeah, and I think that's an indictment of the coaching staff, right? I think that's what everyone points to and says defensively they have issues because of the coaching staff. When you have those four guys up front, again, we're just going to list them out right now: Chase Young, Daron Payne, Jonathan Allen, Montez Sweat. Every NFL team would be in the market for every single one of those players. And then, like you mentioned, I can't say his last name, Matt Ioannidis. Matt Ioannidis. I remember when I was watching, I think it was like the NFL 1000 project for Bleacher Report. I was breaking down like NFC defensive linemen basically week to week. And he was a guy who, even his rookie year, you know, you could see it. You're like, this is very much an NFL player. He might not be a stud, but if that's your third defensive tackle, like, you're happier than a pig rolling in crap. You know what I mean? So William Jackson's had up and down years before. Landy Collins obviously is good in certain situations. Like, he's a very good drop down safety. But beyond that, if you're using him in the middle of the field or anything like that, obviously kind of his limitations show up. And then Kenneth Fuller is like kind of playing in the slot a little bit too, right? Like, when they get into nickel, he kicks in.
Yeah, they started the year with, they have a rookie, Benjamin St. Juste, that they drafted because of his length and his ability to press. And the thought was that they'd have the two kind of press corners in Jackson and St. Juste on the edge. And they'd have Fuller slide into the slot, which is what he did in Washington before he got traded to the Chiefs in the Alex Smith deal. He really struggled moving back into the slot, particularly playing man coverage. And so what they've kind of done recently is they've gone to a three safety nickel package, where Cam Curl has kind of played what they call the Buffalo nickel, which is just big nickel. And he's kind of been playing as the nickel back, and Kendall Fuller stayed outside. And that's been a little bit better for Fuller, but they're still struggling to get everyone on the same page, because then you're playing a little bit more zone with that, because you've got safeties trying to cover slot receivers, and then William Jackson has kind of been struggling on the other side to transition as a guy that's been a press man corner to now trying to play off coverage and zone and with vision and trying to match up different routes. That's not really his game, and he's really struggled with that. So it's kind of been a big mismatch. And you mentioned Landon Collins, that last week they ended up calling him a linebacker, and like that's been the big story in Washington this week. That Ron Rivera has said, I see him as a downhill linebacker, and Collins kind of is taking that as an insult because any safety probably would. But you know, his coverage ability, as you say, deep, is not very good. And he has always been kind of a box safety, and better with his run fits than he has been as a coverage guy. And that's kind of how they played him. Certainly last week against the Chiefs, he played maybe four or five snaps as kind of a deep half safety or a quarter safety, but for the most part, he was a linebacker in the box. It's been a very mismatchy set of parts for Washington on the back end, and just about every week there's something new going wrong, and different holes popping up that they're trying to plug.
How is last guy defensively I want to talk about, Jamin Davis, how has he been playing? I broke him down again because I was working Bleacher Report stuff. I broke down kind of the front seven guys for him in this upcoming draft class. I never really saw first round talent out of him. He obviously was very athletic. He basically wasn't productive until his last year at Kentucky. He's a very young player in that, like, he wasn't even really starting until his last year at Kentucky. So he very much was like a raw guy who, as soon as it kind of like clicked for him in that, like, he could be a feasible player on an SEC field, he then went to the draft. So that's always kind of tricky, where it's like, I wish you would have gotten more reps under you at the college level before you went pro. But he's obviously very athletic. Everything else I thought was kind of a little bit of a limitation. So he was kind of like a work in progress. How has his progress been, you know, this season?
It's been very slow. I think for me, when I watched him, I could see the talent and the potential there, and obviously the athleticism. I thought he was a will. I think you put him as a will linebacker, and you kind of keep him a little bit protected, and he knows his role and he can play it. They basically said, no, you're the Mike, and we're going to try to put as much on your shoulders as possible and see what you can handle. And I understand that thinking long term, because if he can pick it up and he can get into the system early and make all those calls early, then you're set at the Mike position long term. But he struggled picking it all up and making the calls. And you could see in preseason, he was playing Mike and they had John Bostic playing Will, and it was Bostic was the one making all the calls because he was the Mike back last year. So you could see Davis was struggling. And to the start of the season, Davis, every time there was a run play, he was a step late kind of diagnosing exactly what was going on and checking, is the quarterback keeping that on a bootleg, or you know, where exactly was the ball, where exactly is my fit? And that would left him late to plays and, you know, let offensive linemen reach him that offensive linemen shouldn't be reaching him at all because he's incredibly athletic. So you know, that has been an issue for him, and he's had a really slow start. For the first 5 weeks, he I don't think he played more than 50% of the snaps in any of the games. Last week against the Chiefs, I think it started to click for him a little bit. And they had Cole Holcomb take over the play calling. And Holcomb's playing Sam, but he's still calling the plays. And Davis is kind of playing the Mike, but playing the Will at times as well. They're kind of moving guys around up there. As I say, it's quite flexible with where guys are playing right now. Landon Collins is in the mix up there as well. So last week we saw him start to be a little bit more instinctive and start to trigger a little bit quicker. And, you know, he notices a pulling guard. He's like, okay, that's power. I've got to get outside there and scrape to the edge and make that play. So, you know, he's starting to get there slowly. They obviously they want him on the field because of his athleticism and his coverage ability and his coverage potential, certainly. And we saw a little bit of that, but because he's been so slow in the run game, they've not been able to trust him on the field that much. But I think John Bostic got hurt and he's out. So it's basically been either they play Holcomb and Davis together, or they've been experimenting with this 5D line package and a big nickel. So it's literally just been Cole Holcomb, the only linebacker on the field. So they've been kind of hiding him a little bit there. But last week we saw him finally start to get a little bit more reps and show a little bit more of the potential that he does have.
I do always wonder, whenever you get like the head coach who's played the position at a high level and then drafts an athletic guy a little too high at that same position, how much that comes into play, right? Like, how can you go into the room? Like, you're a scout for the Washington football team and you're telling Ron Rivera and Jack Del Rio, both who played linebacker at the NFL level, like, no, this guy can't play. He's athletic, but I don't know if you can coach him up. I don't think that they're going to take "you can't coach him up" too well. You know what I mean? Like, that's always something I wonder. And then you brought up the green dot. That definitely is something that matters in terms of like just getting the comms in and being able to get guys set, right? Even a guy like Miles Jack will tell you he's better when he doesn't have the green dot. That's a Pro Bowl caliber linebacker at the NFL level telling you, I don't really like having the comms. I don't like having all that. I would just kind of want to line up and chase and run and play. And for a lot of those athletic guys, I mean, it might be better to kind of take that off of their plate. Let's get into predictions and wrap this up, because I know you got to get out of here. Packers football team. The Packers are double digit favorites. How are you feeling?
I would say that's probably about right. It's weird because every week I kind of talk myself into thinking, well, if this is the week the defensive line clicks, they can take over a game because they're that talented, and maybe that gives them a chance. And as you say, the Packers have had some issues up front, and maybe the defensive line has been steadily improving and they're getting their act together, but I don't trust the coverage behind them to hold up. And there's kind of been a pattern emerging of how teams have been attacking them and getting the ball out quickly, and Washington just doesn't have an answer for it. So I think I'd be surprised if Washington came particularly close to even keeping the game within a score.
I think I agree with you. I would still take, I would not bet on this game, frankly, with the line that's out there right now, just because I think the book on how to slow Green Bay down, at least not necessarily beat them, but slow them down, is kind of out there. You're seeing every team do it to them. They come out in the game defensively. They play too high. They basically do that, and then it's just bloodletting, right? Just the slow churn down the field until you go up two scores, and then they have to start getting into pressure packages and stuff like that. The one benefit into playing that way is that if you can get a sack, the drive's dead, right? We watched that against Chicago. It only takes one play. If you're forcing them to every play, it's just chipping down the field, and you can get one positive, they're off the field. That's how it works. So that would kind of be my hesitation there on betting on Green Bay in terms of like the point spread. The other thing too, Chicago only allowed 24 points. Green Bay actually converted in the red zone this past week. They went 3 of 4 for touchdowns, and Green Bay on a per play basis had the highest EPA of any team last week. Really? They only scored 24 points because they only got like 6 possessions in the whole game. It's just, right, you just mark it up. And then defensively, their run game outside of Kenny Clark isn't good enough to get teams off of the field. Devondre Campbell's had a great season too. He should legitimately be in the Pro Bowl voting conversation whenever he's up, but they just don't have a lot of dudes up front right now. And part of that is outside linebacker just being so banged up, but there's not a lot of defensive line talent out there either. I mean, you're basically hoping that Dean Lowry gets like 3 penetration plays in the backfield every week, kind of, just to help your run defense. So I'm kind of on the same page with you. I don't know if this is necessarily like bloodbath level. I don't think your team is banged up enough for that, unless, you know, all these wide receivers are out. So that's the big thing, I would think. You know, you can watch some of these teams, like Indianapolis right now was a great example against Baltimore a couple weeks ago on, I think it was Monday night. where they're down to their fourth and fifth cornerback. And then Lamar's, it's just like he's throwing on air. It's like 7-7 basically, right? You can get some of those teams like that. That's when you see the bloodbath is the cluster injuries, especially at prevention positions, right? Like the secondary or the offensive line. I don't think Washington's in that situation right now. So I'm going to take Green Bay, but I would not bet on this game.
Yep, I think that's totally fair.
Do you want to plug your stuff again on the back end right now?
Sure, Candy. So my Twitter is at MarkBullockNFL, my Substack again was markbullock.substack.com.
There we go. Appreciate the time, Mark.
Of course, anytime.